The Real Life Decision, When to Use Lethal Force. For most police officers in this country, the daily job involves dealing with a mix of everyday headaches, fender benders, paperwork, lots and lots of driving. But at any second, in any town, on any street, a routine stop can suddenly escalate into a life-threatening situation and require a split-second decision that can change an officer's life and a suspect's life forever. I'm Keith Shortall, and as the national debate over the use of force by police rages on, we'll talk with the authors of Shots Fired, a new book about what they say are the misunderstandings, misconceptions, and myths about police shootings. Joe Laughlin's the former assistant chief of police for the city of Portland, and Kate Clark Flora is a writer and former attorney who worked at the Maine Attorney General's office. A career cop's take on the real experience of deadly encounters. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. On TV and in the movies, the good cop always seems to be able to shoot the bad guy either in the arm or the leg and then calmly make the arrest. But in real life, under life-threatening circumstances, police will tell you that it's rarely so simple to disarm someone with a single shot or by using a taser. Today we're going to discuss what goes through the mind of a police officer in those moments leading up to the decision to use deadly force and what they go through after a shooting. In the studio with me, Kate Clark Flora. She writes true crime stories and police procedurals. And Joe Laughlin is a former assistant chief of police for the city of Portland, who also served as the commander of the Special Reaction Team. Laughlin and Flora's new book is called Shots Fired. They previously collaborated on the true crime story Finding Amy, which was nominated for an Edgar Award. As always, we want to hear from you. The phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Keith.
Joe, so we were talking, reminiscing, really, before the show, because I've known you for some, 30-odd years. But for those of our listeners who don't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself. Did you always want to be a cop?
Never. I had no inclination to be a police officer. I was raised in a New York metropolitan area. And it's the last thing that was on my mind. I went to college up here. My dad sent me to St. Joe's College. And I returned to New York and inadvertently got involved in a job in a police department. And I was stunned at what I saw. And I had a very sophomoric view about cops, like a lot of people, and cynical. And I was hooked. And I was surprised at the volume of incidents that people dealt with in one day alone and how good most of them were. So I came back to Portland, and I saw Portland as an evolving city that was changing, and I wanted to be part of it and make a difference, and I signed up for the police. Here I am.
So you
it's
said
over.
But what about it appealed to you? I mean, were you one of these, what you wanted to help people, or you just thought it was interesting work?
Well, it's a combination of things. You know, that's what the proverbial expression is, I want to help people, and you do. That's a fundamental part of it, because you go to so many different challenges and the human dynamics that are rapidly evolving. It's a great feeling to be able to resolve something in a crisis where people are going to get injured or something really bad is going to happen. And it's a good feeling. So the mental challenge, the physical challenge, and the fact that you're just going from one thorny situation to the next is there was a lot to it. So it really challenged me on a lot of levels, and I loved it.
Would you say, though, that you were prepared for the work? Did you go in with eyes wide open?
No one is. Any person, you know, like all of us, I was raised on TV, movies, and Hollywood movies, and I had a very sophomoric view of police, and actually a bad view of police, you know, like a lot of us, until I got involved. But I was not prepared for the realities of it, and I was actually stunned the first few times I went to a domestic. I never saw my parents fight, especially the violence. You know, and so, you know, going to real crimes in progress and all those types of challenges. And also, you deal with a lot of sadness every day and a lot of people who are at their worst, especially, you know, children and abused women and things of that nature. It really, it has a profound effect on you. So the reality of it, sinks in when you first arrive, and also the violence. You know, I found myself in the hospital a couple times as a young man, never expecting it. And then you cross this, like, bridge around 5 years. Well, do I really want to stay in this profession, and do I want to continue? And that's how it evolves. It takes time. But, yeah, I was definitely surprised how crazy and challenging the job was.
We'll talk more about that in a few minutes, Kate. Tell us about your background. You went to law school. Were you interested in using that skill to help people?
Yeah, I went to Northeastern, which is what we call the radical law school. It was the people's law school, and got my dream job out of law school, which was working in the Maine Attorney General's office. I was in the Department of Human Services, and then I went on to represent the Human Rights Commission. So I got to be the girl in the white hat. And I stopped practicing law when I started writing seriously, and that was quite a lot of years ago.
Did that experience, though, in the Attorney General's office working with what we call in the vernacular deadbeat dads, but also child protection, did that inform, your view of either law enforcement or any of the other things that you write about?
Well, I write police procedurals in my fictional life, so it absolutely did. And I feel like I should have something wonderfully articulate to say at this point. You know, basically, I think that I was like everybody else. You know, I wanted to do good for the public, but I had the same skepticism about the police going in that Joe had starting his career. But you can't even write crime fiction, I don't think, without spending a lot of time understanding the reality of police world, even before I started writing nonfiction.
There's a quote in the book, and I can't remember the guy who says it, but it says basically, look, if you want to be loved, be a firefighter, right? Because they swoop in and they save the day.
Right.
But you know, police officers do that too, but they also give you tickets, and they're the one that tells you to come and turn your music down. So there is this kind of, and as you said, you admitted to maybe having a negative view of police. But you understand why that is. You're sort of bugging people and forcing them to do things, and so it's hard to balance and say, "Look, I'm actually here to help you."
That's the typical way people view police, like giving out a ticket or sitting in their car, maybe rolling on a domestic. But I'll answer that with, people have very little realistic information about what police officers do on a day-to-day basis, and the challenges they face and the trauma they face in one shift alone. They work and function in a world that goes well beyond the realm of normal experiences. So you're doing everything from a ticket, which is distasteful, to shots fired, to homicide, to a lot of death and a lot of destruction of people's lives. So I think the general public has sort of I don't want to use the word twisted, but not a really...
Uninformed would be...
Uninformed, yeah. Thank you. Thank you, yeah. Kate. It's true. So... you know, that's a typical association people make with police, but a lot of times, most people don't see what we're doing. We're not in the average citizen's homes. We're in lower socioeconomic, or what I call no socioeconomic areas, dealing with, you know, terrible situations, which is punctuated by violence. But the other thing that police do, 70% of their time is spent shuttling people through the myriad of social services and all of societal ills, whether it's the drug, the deranged, the mentally ill, and so on.
Would you say that there is, with this community policing movement, which has been an attempt to not just change the image of police officers, but actually make them more involved, is there pressure for police officers to be officer friendly and be all these things in ways that they weren't expected to before?
Well, there really is no pressure. Community policing is a philosophy, and I always said, if we haven't been policing the community for all these years, who the heck have we been policing? And the philosophy behind it is getting out of your cars, getting engaged with the public, and you know, it's a great feeling when you're out talking to people and you create benevolent connections and things that work. And it also is a benefit to the city or the town that you're working in, because people get to know the police, people and police get to know the people. The problem with today is we're going back to chasing the radio 911 calls, because since the difficulty and the pernicious rhetoric and pervasive misconceptions about police, nobody wants to sign up anymore. So every police department I go to, I still work with police in another job, they're down 20 people. I'm down 30 people. Dallas, for instance, is down 500 people. So therefore, the community suffers because they can't engage. They're running around going back to 911. I know Portland has an exemplary, very responsive, educated organization. And I know they're down in numbers. And these are things we predicted years ago. It affects the community. Community policing is engaging the public and getting out there. It works. We know it works. But we need person power.
Why did you write this book?
Oh, wow. I started off with another book called No Reason, which is a rhetorical title. Because you can't make any reason about what you see on a daily basis, and also the misconceptions that people have about police. When Ferguson happened, and I was watching that evolve, and the convulsed nation, and the results that happened afterwards, I felt strongly. I had sections in the book about deadly force and what really happens to the police officers and the trauma that they're faced in the aftermath and all of the protracted investigations by multiple organizations. People have no information about deadly force and the reality of that. So I focused on that. And to the audience, I know this is a tough topic. It's hard, but it's important so we can create an emotional conduit between police and the public to say, hey, wait a second, these are human beings. They're people just like you and I.
And to some extent, and I'm generalizing here, and I don't want to speak for everybody, but on some level, does the public want police not to be human, to somehow be able to have some sort of special training that allows them to not respond emotionally and do better than that than the rest of us?
Right. It's of course. Police are held to a higher standard than they should be. But, you know, the human dynamic is there. I think people have sort of a robotic view about police and that they're composed of one large entity or commodities, and it's not true. We have to develop a veneer or some cynicism to negotiate the world we live in. But yeah, people have very little realistic information about it. But we're just people just like you.
And we'll get to some of the basics of the book about dispelling what you believe are misconceptions,
right,
and challenging some of the myths. But Kate, I assume you talked about the fact that you knew that when this would be published, some people would look at it without even reading it and say, oh, here they come, the apologist books from the police.
Yeah, I guess that I'm still a dreamer, Keith. I still think that it's important to give a voice to this part of the conversation. And, you know, you write the book hoping that people will pick it up open-minded and have the reaction that people do when they actually read it, which is to say, I had no idea. So that if I have a law school classmate who says to me, after describing an incident where a knife-wielding, mentally disturbed person charges a police officer and gets shot, why didn't the police just shoot the knife out of his hand like they used to? I know that even what I would think of as the best informed and relatively sophisticated people don't even have a basic understanding of what's going into those incidents. And so what we were really saying is, this isn't the answer, this isn't the be-all and end-all. This is a piece of the conversation, and this book helps to inform it.
And you do that through these accounts, which are very detailed. And as you say, you know, rather sort of than lecturing at people about ballistics or the properties of particular guns and all of that, you allow the participants to describe what happened moment by moment. And the other interesting thing was, I noticed, you don't edit out or filter the language used by those who are describing it and even how they describe the subjects in these cases.
It's true. And part of that, I mean, we had a lot of conversation back and forth about, you know, do you cut this? Do you take that out? But when you read the stories as told by people who've just been in terrifying situations, really harrowing situations, and they speak about it in their own language, and some of them are very young. You know, you've got rookies involved in their first situation, like the story that opens the book. And if we could filter it out, we could clean it up. But I think giving people an authentic voice, actually talking to them about what it's like to be clinging to the side of a speeding car and afraid that you're at 60 miles an hour, you can't let go, or what it's like, to be in that dark stairwell and your partner's being stabbed and you can't see anything and you're trying to save his life. These are, you know, these are very immediate. They're very intense. And that's what we want people to see. We wanted people to see the reality. We wanted to give these officers a voice.
Let's get directly here before we start taking calls and take a break into some of these misconceptions. So Kate was just mentioning, some people saying, hey, why didn't you just, you know, shoot the guy in the leg or shoot the gun out of his hand?
Right.
Is this one of the top ones that you're trying to get at?
There's many. And that, you know, people expect these events to defy the laws of physics and reality. But to shoot, even in a sterile environment, if we're in a range, and I'm trying to shoot your hand moving, it's pretty impossible to do. These events happen within moments. You use that's an operative word. It's not seconds, it's moments. And the average engagement is over in 3 seconds. And most officers are bewildered, like, what just happened? Why did this person make me do that? So a twisting, turning human being that is violent or attacking, people don't stand there and present themselves like the movie, and there's no pithy dialogue prior to that. These events happen so quickly, and it's illustrated in the book. And these are direct interviews with officers that have been involved, and there were dozens of others. So that just doesn't happen. That's an unrealistic view. I couldn't do that now. If you're standing and moving around the room, it doesn't happen like TV, the movies in Hollywood. It doesn't happen like that.
The other idea that one shot will
drop. That's a good one. Yeah. Well, wound ballistics, when it comes into this, is that, and we illustrate that many times in the book, especially with the Boston bombers, the Sarnay brothers. One brother was shot 9 times, ran over twice, and still fighting with the police. Bullets don't knock people down. The energy of a bullet in wound ballistics is equivalent to a major league fastball pitch. So people who are on crack, heroin, or whatever, or enraged with anger, adrenaline, bullets do not stop people. People can still function for 3 or 4 minutes and kill others or harm others with multiple deadly wounds in their body, or it depends upon tissue damage. Wound ballistics is a long story, but it's not the movies. You know, people don't get blown off their feet and fall down and stop. It doesn't happen like that. On occasion it does, but not in real life.
And another common one that we hear with the evolution of tasers, et cetera, these technologies, why didn't you just tase them?
Right. Yeah. Actually, we do. This is another misconception people have. Why didn't they use less lethal? We use less lethal all day long. Every 2 minutes, a taser is used in this country and in Canada. Pepper mace, beanbag rounds, batons, and that is common. That's all day long. There are 34,000 arrests every day in this country, most of which go pretty smoothly. But there are a lot of violent situations where police save people in these engagements through less lethal rounds. You know, I saw a post on Facebook. It was running around. There's millions of crazy posts on Facebook, obviously. And there's a guy with a sword. I think he was in London or someplace like that. And the cops were dealing with him and ultimately solved the case without killing him. And of course, the headline was, if this was the United States, he'd have been dead in a minute, you know. That's not true. We do things like that. Cops do. Police do that all day long. Less lethal is used all the time.
But not everyone is trained in it.
Not everyone is trained in it. So not everyone carries a taser, or not everyone has access to a beanbag round. You know, but the last thing you want to do is deadly force. Any officer that I've talked to, in fact, during these interviews, I had to stop the tape all the time because they were getting emotional, they would get upset. Many of them got up and walked away because they couldn't continue. But less than 5% of police officers ever use their weapon during their entire career, self-included. You know, I've had mine out, obviously. I spent many years on the SRT team. But thank God I never had to use it, because you watch what other people go through when they go through these events. It's horrible. It has a profound, painful impact on their life, their community, their families. There's no good outcomes in these things.
All right, we'll talk more about that when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. The number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Northeast Delta Dental. Dental benefits for businesses of all sizes, including individual and family plans. Details at northeastdeltadental.com. and Dehan Wealth Advisors, an independently owned wealth management firm providing investment advice to individuals, families, and institutions. Information at DEIGHAN.com. And Good Shepherd Food Bank, partnering to end hunger in Maine. Harvesting hope for families in need this holiday season. Learn how you can help at feedingmaine.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Guillermo del Toro talks about directing his new film, The Shape of Water. He also directed Pan's Labyrinth. And Cullen Murphy describes growing up the son of a comic strip artist during the golden age of the Sunday newspaper comics. His father drew the popular Prince Valiant strip, which Cullen eventually wrote. He has a new memoir. Join us.
Tonight at 7 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. Iceland is a country rich in culture, but also of sharp contrasts, where dark winters are offset by the summer's midnight sun. If you've ever wanted to travel to Iceland, consider joining Maine Public Travel next June from the 17th through the 23rd. Experience the Northern Lights, geothermal pools, breathtaking waterfalls, and even meet up with our own Jen Rooks, who will host a talk show from Roof, Iceland's public broadcasting organization. For more information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Education or call 1-877-479-7040. Again, 1-877-479-7040. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, a different look at police shootings. With me in the studio, Joe Laughlin. He's a former assistant chief of police for the city of Portland, Maine, also served as the commander of the Special Reaction Team, and was a team member for more than 20 years. Kate Clark Flora writes True Crime and Police Procedurals. Laughlin and Flora previously collaborated on the true crime story, Finding Amy. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I do want to talk about what happens in the aftermath of a shooting, and you were mentioning that this is traumatizing for the officers involved, but I do want to first go to this other myth that we were talking about right before the break, which was people say, well, he or she, the suspect was unarmed. Why did you need to use lethal force?
Right. Again, these things are explosive. They happen within moments. But an unarmed person has a very different meaning to police officers because there is always a weapon available, and that is the officers. So to start off, in several studies that I examined and in my own experiences, 11% of the officers within a two-year period are killed by unarmed people. They have their guns taken away, or they're stomped or beaten to death, or, you know, crushed to death, or whatever. 3,000 people a year, 3,000 plus a year in this country, are killed by unarmed people. So if I were to, you know, be on drugs or something, or and I can do a lot of damage to the people that are surrounding me right now just by with my hands or grabbing something in this room. So that has a very, very different meaning to police officers, because I've seen guys throw four cops around like rag dolls, and also we used our less lethal means on them as well, and it doesn't even have an effect. Or spray someone in the face with mace, doesn't even affect them. And they're totally unarmed. They do not have any weapons. And a lot of officers, here's another point, Keith. There are 60,000 assaults on officers every year, and that's the ones that are reported. There are thousands of officers that have been shot in the face, beaten, stabbed, they're on breathing tubes, they're in wheelchairs, just like our veterans. No one hears a word about any of that. And no one sees these videotapes played over and over again. So there's a whole other world that our citizens aren't exposed to.
The book also tries, successfully conveys, I think, the effect that this has emotionally on these many of these officers who are involved. This is the same reaction that anyone would have involved in a violent episode of this type and taking someone else's life. But it's your view that maybe the public perception is that police just don't feel that or are somehow immune to that?
Well, that's the public perception that's created, Keith, by TV. You know, if they watch the same cop on a cop show for 8 years, once a week, shoot somebody, holster a weapon, and walk away, that gives the impression that police are unfazed by what actually happens to them, whereas one of the things that we felt was really important to emphasize in the book was the fact that it's not over when, you know, the shooting is done. There's all of that levels and levels of interagency and intra-agency investigations, but then there's the emotional impact on an officer of having actually taken a human life. And, you know, I came into this book having worked with a game warden on a book called A Good Man with a Dog. You know, he had pulled 200 people out of the woods over the course of a 25-year career, and the impacts just add up. And we don't take into account that you have the micros, and then this cascades the whole thing.
Yeah, can I follow up with that? Is that these events are piercingly painful and has a terrible traumatic effect on the individual? Because I've been in multiple shooting scenes. The officer doesn't know if the person is deceased, and a lot of them are saying, I hope the guy lives, I hope he's okay, and you'll stay with, you know, just like you would see or in the movies. However, once the person expires, I remember telling several officers, look, the man has passed away. And they were devastated. And then living with the fact that you have to deal with the death of another human being, and then you're going through multiple protracted investigations that doesn't end for years. And there's always the potential of being prosecuted, definitely civil sued as well, and all these investigations that go on and on. It has a profound effect on the individual.
Early on in the book, you cite the case of the incident involving Officer Sweat. And yeah, this was a few years ago.
Right.
He and a rookie, Officer McGarry, are chasing a suspect who'd caused some turmoil and made threats at a local bar. Suspect's in a abandoned garage. It's dark. I can't go through the whole scene,
right,
but it's kind of a scary scene. And in the end, Officer Sweat is severely injured with a knife. The suspect is ultimately killed. And Officer McGarry, in the aftermath here, is shaken by what he had to do to save his partner, but is also, interestingly, feels like he's treated as a suspect because he is sort of treated like a suspect.
Well, that's true. It's not TV. These people don't walk away unscathed. They're isolated, they're separated, and they are treated like a suspect until we can determine otherwise. So there's multiple investigations going on, and I expressed this earlier, is that when we pull up on these scenes, we don't even know what happens. So when something goes out on a tweet or a Facebook or on the news, you know, and everybody's left to think that this is what the cops did again, it takes us time to determine what happens. But in that case, those are amazing men. And by the way, both of them are commanders in the police department now. They're still there, even after James Sweat's injuries. It's pretty powerful.
All right, let's go to the phones here. We'll bring in Elizabeth calling from Columbia Falls. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
I was wondering, as racial tensions are rising around this situation of officers using deadly force and as they rise with the general public and their view of the police, how did you collect different perspectives as you were writing or take that racial tension into account in your own life, because you're speaking to, you know, a mostly white audience right now? So I was wondering how that affects you and how you're dealing with it.
Well, I deliberately stayed away from race because I'm trying to show the human equation behind this, and we both stayed away from the race issue because that is a 10-volume book. It goes on forever exponentially. What we're trying to do is create an emotional conduit for people to open up conversations and have a better dialogue. I've done a lot of research. I've examined Center for Disease Control, the FBI database, as well as Richard Johnson's study. That was one of the best in the Washington Post reports. And people have been led to believe that there's an epidemic of police shootings in this country. It is simply not true. And then if you break down the demographics, when everyone sees the same videos played over and over again, it gets inside the psyche of the American public. And I think we have a lot of good citizens, no matter what race, no matter what creed, confused. And the point of this book is not to get into to race, but get into the human beings behind the badge. And let's open our conversations and expand and try to bring us together instead of staying apart like we have been.
And you're not making the case that there's no such thing as an inappropriate or wrong use of force.
There are. Yeah. Well, this book does not excuse bad cops, terrible tactics, or horrible situations. That happens. You know, and bad cops, let me just say, is that we do everything in our power, and I was an administrator at the end of my career, to get rid of bad cops. And there's some, let's face facts, there's some jerks out there, and, you know, I work with them over the years. But we do everything in our power to get those people away because they do so much damage to the good officers. By and large, the good officers and the good things that are done every day and the lives that we save every single day, again, going back to the 34,000 arrests.
Apart from the good cops and bad cops, there are policy questions around engagement. And do you need to go chase the guy into the dark garage, or can you wait till he comes out? I mean, these are things that I think that you probably talk about all the time.
We talk about it all the time. You know, for example, the Portland Police is a very educated, responsive organization. We change policies and procedures on a weekly basis. We learn from our mistakes and we grow. I'm not saying that every department does that, but good police departments look at, okay, what went wrong? What went right? What can we do better? Who and how can we do that? How do we change our policies and procedures? That happened right up to the day I walked out the door. We do that all the time. And by the way, the case you're referring to happened many, many years ago in the 90s. There was different policies and procedures then. To answer the callers, We're always constantly looking for better ways to do business, and we need to work with the public on that, too. And part of that is getting a better public understanding.
Let's go to Janice in Washington. Hi, Janice.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
This sounds like a very interesting book. I am looking forward to reading it. I have a question that's sort of on the subject, but a little bit a police perspective of community watch groups in which members are armed. I'm thinking of the case in Florida with George Zimmerman, and a couple of questions with that, one of which is you had somebody who was asked to stand down by the police dispatcher who basically was stalking a 17-year-old who it sounds like was trying to avoid him, who was not armed, doing nothing illegal, was shot and was initially, it was because it's a stand-your-ground state, as I understood it, there was not much really made of it initially. But the other part of the question is, I listened to the transcripts, and Mr. Zimmerman said that the young fellow was beating him, which to me would have been stand-your-ground if somebody is following you. But nonetheless, that aside, he said that he shot him, and the kid fell backwards and said, "You got me." My question is, I've been on ambulance for many years, and I've seen people not die from being shot, but they generally, I've never heard anybody kind of say a cowboy movie line like, "You got me." You know, that sounds like somebody who is sort of living a fantasy and hoping to find a real-life human to fulfill this fantasy. So what do you think about armed community watch people? What's your thoughts on somebody saying "you got me" if they're shot with one gunshot, which, as you said, it's, you know, that's unusual to die from that. And also the other question was, those were the same question. The other question was, do you have any thoughts or feelings, or what do the officers that you interviewed and got to know think about the limitless firepower that people are allowed to have, guns that might be more powerful than our police?
Sure. Okay, Janice, thanks. We want to get to these questions.
There's a lot to that. There's a lot of questions in there. You know, the first part of that is that I am not big, and most police are not big on having armed people in community watches. You know, perhaps pepper mace. What they're supposed to be doing is the eyes and ears of the police department and calling 911, engaging someone. And if you're not highly trained, and I'll switch over to the police, you know, not all police are as trained as people may think. So I am not big with weapons in the hand of community watch people at all. pepper mace would probably be the best thing to defend themselves, but they should just be reporting it in. The other confusion there is that that case, Zimmerman is not a police officer, but they lump that into, you know, the whole police rhetoric, anti-police rhetoric that went on. I don't know all the parameters or contours of that particular case, but obviously there were mistakes. The dispatch, I do know, at the time said, just stay where you are and report us in and tell us where this person is. So that's I'm not good with armed guards walking around like that.
All right. Her other question was about police facing increasingly powerful, more weapons. We have to save that until after the break. We'll take a quick.
The only thing I would, if we got one second,
Yeah.
I would say, you know, if you read the interviews in this book, you will see that even though "You Got Me" doesn't sound credible, there are people say astonishing things when they've been shot, don't they, Joe?
Yes, I mean all so unpredictable.
What did you do to me?
Interesting. All right, we're going to take a break. First, though, a word about tomorrow's show. Join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation about sexual harassment. Jennifer and her guests will discuss the history of harassment and what recourse is available to those who have experienced this. Email your comments, questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Ocean View at Falmouth, committed to sustainability and dedicated to offering active retirement living with peace of mind for the future. And the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs at Colby College, inspiring active citizenship in the world of public affairs. And Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
Many powerful men in media and entertainment who've been accused of sexual misconduct have been fired or resigned in recent months. But in politics, similar allegations don't have the same impact.
It's all been quite fascinating and sad all at the same time, and we're still, it didn't change anything.
I'm Kelly McEvers, Sexual Misconduct in the Era of Trump, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. And at 2 o'clock for Public Affairs Program, it's World Affairs. The topic will be climate change. Again, 2 o'clock this afternoon on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a conversation with the authors of the new book, Shots Fired. In the studio with me, former Assistant Chief of Police for the City of Portland, Joe Laughlin, and author Kate Clark Flora. They are co-authors of Shots Fired. Join our conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Caribou and Larry. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, hi, Keith. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I'd just like to tell a brief story to the point of what the gentleman was making, the lady was making, in terms of unarmed suspects. My son works as a police officer in another state. There was a routine traffic stop. The perpetrator tried to drag the police officer. He called in assistance. They chased the suspect. The suspect went up on the lawn. The car turned around. The suspect came at the two police officers. My son pursued him in a second vehicle. The perpetrator caused an accident. And then when a Good Samaritan came along, he stole the Good Samaritan's car. And finally, you know, my son was on foot with his colleagues. And the guy came out of an alley driving the stolen car, tried to run my son down. So my son was able to fire two shots, wound him with one, and managed to get out of the way before being hit. And then later, the municipal police were able to stop this gentleman after he'd gone into shock. And his excuse was, oh, the police had beaten my brother up after he evaded them, you know, when they tried to arrest him. So that was his excuse. And that's the kind of thing that police officers have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, and they never know when a routine traffic stop is going to escalate into mayhem.
Yeah, Larry, thanks. And this, I guess, goes to this issue of the unarmed suspect. There is always a weapon of some sort.
Yeah, I think that when we were talking earlier about, you know, a human hand, a brick and everything. But in any conflict with a police officer, there's a gun available. And so that, you know, that and I think we don't always recognize that a car is a weapon.
Yeah. Let's go to Brittany in Waterville. Hi, Brittany.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, I mean, I think we can both understand that viewing police in a negative way and also the excessive use of force are two things that do occur. My argument is that systematic change in the programs would help to kind of solve both dilemmas because I know that police officers are subject to these split-second decisions and high-stress situations. So the mental health diagnoses and PTSD is really prevalent among this population. So doing trainings like testing physiological responses to stress so they know how their body can react to stress, or changing the police culture in the precincts to allow police officers to access mental health services without feeling stigmatized. And then just a general, you know, training, as you said earlier, not everybody is trained on the use of tasers and everything, and that would make police officers and civilians feel more comfortable, I feel. And then just a general increase in the access of mental health services around to kind of combat those feelings, and which you discussed earlier on how they feel, you know, terrible after a situation like that. And then moving forth in their career, they might be able to handle situations like that feeling a little bit more comfortably.
Thank you, Brittany. This sounds a lot like what's in the prescription at the back of
the
book.
Yeah, the prescription is that, you know, changing the culture of an organization, one of the things that we're not very good at is asking for help. I've seen more cops hurt and injured by the trauma they've experienced, and yourself included to some degree, than I've seen any cop hurt by any gun or knife. There should be systems in place to address the PTSD that you deal with on a day-to-day basis and the intense trauma and rapidly evolving situations that you deal with. The problem is nationwide, this is a neglected area, and we need, you know, a holistic approach to police officers. This takes money. This takes time. We need to infuse money into these programs, I think, from the federal government to have a cultural change, a cultural shift in regard to how we deal with things. I mean, it's not John Wayne out there. The movies look pretty cool, but real life is not like that. So we did that in the Portland Police Department. Years ago, I became part of that, employee assistance programs, peer support networks. But by and large, across the nation, they don't have really good systems in place. We're not really good with that. So she had a great point. We need to deal with that and address that on a national level.
All right, let's go to Zeb in Portland. Hi, Zeb. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? I want to say thank you to your guests for their service. Definitely appreciate it. So my question relates to military service and the training that veterans would receive, and how that sort of translates to, you know, domestic policing. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of vets return from combat zones, and, you know, they bring back a lot of that training and sort of that thinking and those methodologies. I'm a vet myself, and I have a lot of friends that are police officers that have, you know, done this thing, and we've discussed it quite a bit. So I'm wondering if your guests see a correlation between, you know, vets entering domestic police departments and this perception that's being created that police officers are, you know, more aggressive and creating this us versus them mentality and distancing themselves from the people they're supposed to be policing.
Okay, Zeb, we'll let them answer that. I think what he seems to be intimating that maybe you're trained, you know, to if you're fighting overseas in close quarters, you have one way of using your gun to protect you and your buddy, and then you return here to become a police officer. It's a much more restrained protocol.
Yeah. Very. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. No, we actually address that in the book. The differences in training between what you have to do in a military situation and what you must do in a community policing situation.
Right. I mean, police are trained to protect and serve. It's like I always say, there's no greater feeling than going to something that's terrifying where people are going to get hurt, and you resolve that and save everyone from getting hurt, including the suspect. But the MOS, so to speak, the method of service in the military is very, very different than it is in, you know, our society with the police. We're trained to protect and serve and use deadly force as a last resort.
Let's go to Arthur in Wolfboro, New Hampshire. Hi, Arthur.
Hello. Hi. I'd like to say thank you also for what you've done and for what you're doing by opening up the line of communications. I'm originally from New York City, and as a youth, we had a lot of beat cops, as we called them then, and we all knew them by name. They knew us. And I think what happened was that's the first thing that happened was that when they went into cars and we lost their faces, we lost their names. And I think that's part of the problem. Of course, there's large areas where they can't do that, and there's small areas where they can. I live in Wolfboro, and the police here are pretty well known to everybody. But Zeb, before, kind of caught you on what I wanted to ask was, what do you think? I wanted to go further. What do you think about the militarization of police in certain areas? Obviously, it's not everywhere. But I think that also adds to the problem where, as you said or pointed out earlier, you have these constant pictures over and over again. Well, now you have these constant pictures of these police, you know, militarized and militarized outfits, militarized weapons, and it's not really the true picture of most police, like especially like here in Wolfboro. So anyway, I wanted to know what you thought of the militarization of the police forces.
Well, to start off with what you had expressed initially is that I was raised in New York, too, and we knew the officers, and they were out of their cars, and there was a lot of contact, and, you know, they knew who was who, especially if you go into certain different precincts or different areas. We've gotten away from that. We were good with it for a while in the 90s. We know it works. We got to get back to that. But we need numbers. The numbers of police officers in this country, which is not a lot, 750,000, has dropped dramatically as a result of the last, you know, 4 or 5 years of all the stuff that happened in the country. As far as the militarization, you know, perception becomes reality. There's been a lot of media stuff on, like, hey, look what these guys are doing. They're getting armed vehicles. They're in BDUs. They're in, you know, there's a time and place for that. It's important on how we deploy those types of pieces of equipment. So perception becomes a reality. But what I see is the media in a broad brush, and I'm not imputing everyone, is that they paint that picture like the cops want to be the military. And that's not the case. You know, that's not the case. I do think it's important on how we deploy those types of weapons or vehicles or even uniforms. You know, a soft-toned uniform is a much better approach to dealing with people.
Megan asks on Facebook, have your guests seen the documentary The Force? And if so, what did they come away with?
I have not seen it.
Well, there's something on you can check that out. Let's go to Sue in Casco. Hi, Sue.
Yeah. Hi there. I want to just say, you know, I appreciate the conversation today. I'm hearing, unfortunately, a lot of excuses, apparently, from the officers. I don't understand, you know, why I'm not hearing more in terms of preventative measures and measures to train officers so that these incidents of fatalities instantaneously don't keep occurring. I mean, our country seems to be one of the worst for this type of situation from officers in you know, lack of training, lack of equipment. It seems like, you know, we need to have cameras on all of the officers all the time. It prevents, you know, it protects them as well as any other people involved.
Good points. Really good points. You know, first of all, cameras are not a panacea. The police welcome cameras. We've had cameras in our cars in Portland for many, many years, and it really helped so many times and so many investigations. Body cameras, officers embrace those, but you got to remember they're two-dimensional. They don't see 360. So close your left eye and look with your right eye. You're only going to see a part of the equation. There's a lot. She had a lot of questions in there in regard to training. Like, de-escalation is the big buzzword now. Well, we've been de-escalating. That's the first thing I learned, you know, in the early 80s when I became a police officer. Calm people down. Try to de-escalate the situation. We do that every single day, to the tune of tens of thousands of times a day, and in any little city. So we tried to de-escalate, and I'll tell you why. We don't want to get hurt. We don't want you to get hurt. And there's training needs to always be a constant. The training and education of police officers has to be constant. It has to be every day and improved. The problem is they cut the training budgets nationwide. We need more training. We need to infuse money into training. We need to infuse money into personnel and into manpower and the proper equipment. But to get to her point, de-escalation is powerful, and we use de-escalation all the time, whether no matter what the person we're dealing with.
Do you think that some of these incidents that have put us where we are could have been prevented, avoided with
totally.
Better training?
Totally. I can think of two or three of them right off the bat. You know, how you approach the matter, but what information you have. So if we're assigned to right here at Maine Public Radio for a terrible incident, by the time we get here, things have changed. You don't know. You have bits and pieces of information from the 911 center to make a determination when you arrive. The whole event may be in another building. But absolutely, I've seen poor tactics can lead to a horrible tragedy or a horrible event. So that is a good point. Training and education is paramount to our success, but it's also people have to be patient because we don't always have all the information and all of the available resources to deal with these matters. But she has a lot of good points.
30 seconds. Your goal, I guess, and one of the goals in writing this book is to change public perceptions about police officers, but also write a prescription for how police departments and training could get better.
Absolutely. At the end of the book, we enumerate 10 pieces of, you know, solutions of what we can do better, what can we do as a country to bring us together. You know, a lot of people say, hey, you know, it's good to hear the other side. I go, well, I got news for you. There are no sides. The police are the people and the people are the police. We got to have an emotional connection. I can throw stats at you all day long, but we need to open up conversations, expand our mind a little bit, and see, you know, what really happens in the reality of it. So I hope this book makes a difference. And, you know, I was very motivated to do this, as painful as it was for us multiple times. So right, thank you.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. Thanks to Kate Clark Flora, author, and who once worked in the Maine Attorney General's office. She co-wrote A Good Man with a Dog, a memoir about a retired Maine game warden, and Joe Laughlin, former assistant chief of police for the city of Portland, who also served as the commander of the Special Reaction Team and was a team member for more than 20 years. Together, Laughlin and Flora previously collaborated on the true crime story Finding Amy. And their new book, of course, is Shots Fired. Sandra Baker ran the board today. Owen Manahan answered your calls, and you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation about sexual harassment. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.